Our next guest has written a number of terrific books about baseball, The Baseball Codes, Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic on the Oakland A's of the early 70s, and his newest takes a look at L.A., the Dodgers of the early 1980s. It's called They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen. Jason Turbo joins us. Jason, welcome back.
Great to be here, Rich. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, another great book. This was such a fun read. It was so great to go back in time and revisit this incredibly memorable team. And as always, much like those Oakland A's teams that you chronicled, just a team filled with characters.
Yeah, well, that's what makes for good stories, I think. It's easy to talk about championship teams, and I guess there has to be a certain degree of character within any championship team. But when you've got a team full of people who made the engine run in very palpable ways, I think it's a really interesting thing to dissect them and figure out how that worked and why that was.
The book ends for this story on one end, Fernando Valenzuela, but on the other end, Tommy Lasorda. And I knew some of the backstory, but this is a guy who was in many ways auditioning for this Dodgers managerial job for years, all the way back to his minor league days. Ownership was just worried he couldn't stop fighting long enough to be a manager.
Well, Lasorda was one of those guys that's known as a 4A player for the duration of his minor league career, right? Someone who is, on the top echelon of the minor leagues, but not quite good enough to make it as a major leaguer. And he had a very successful, very extended run as a minor leaguer, in large part because he was so darn feisty, right? He was not at all cowed by the prospect of knocking someone down. And he would stand up for himself at every opportunity. And it really did run him out of the Dodgers organization by the end. He just started one too many fights. He kind of crawled back on his hands and knees saying, please give me another chance. Well, the chance they gave him was as a minor league manager, and he made the most of it. Under strict orders, don't fight so much. It took him a little bit of time. He actually got in some dust-ups as a minor league skipper. But he righted the ship. But ultimately, I think that was really one of his true strengths as a manager was his deep passion, not only for the sport, but for the Dodgers. He spent 8 years as a minor league manager there in places like Pocatello and Ogden, Utah. And that's where he came up with all these sayings about bleeding Dodger blue and praying to the big Dodger in the sky. And he would hug his players after home runs. And he was a vociferous on-field cheerleader. To the degree that a lot of people said, you got to knock that off because it'll never play in the big leagues. This is harming your future prospects. Luckily for Lasorda and the Dodgers, he paid no attention. He kept it right up all the way into the big league clubhouse, and it continued to work for him as a big league manager. I mean, all the players who were instrumental to his early success had played for him in the minors. They knew what they were getting. They were used to being hugged after home runs, and it worked. He went to the World Series his first two seasons. As the Dodgers manager.
And that energy was certainly genuine, and he showed that right away, meeting with players individually when he got the job, sending them letters to the point where he pretty much sold everybody on the roster.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't only the players, although that's certainly true. I mean, I talked to a number of guys who had never experienced that kind of thing before, like taking the manager taking such a deep degree of interest where he's sending them letters. I mean, Dusty Baker still has the letters that Lasorda sent him. But what struck me was the letter that Lasorda sent to not Mike Socha, but Mike Socha's mother when they drafted Socha
right.
out of high school. She was set on him going to college, and Lasorda took the time to write a letter to this woman who he had no business writing a letter to. He could easily have turned his back and everything would have been fine. But he understood that dynamic and how it worked, and he wanted Mrs. Socha to make sure that she knew the team was taking care of her son, and they did. I mean, he was as genuine as they come.
It was an interesting roster, a good mix of veterans and young guys. Can you talk about coconut snatching, what that concept was, and how it was crucial to building this 81 team?
Well, the Dodgers were not built on ceremony in terms of drafting a guy as a first baseman and having him play first base all the way through to the big leagues. They would plug guys in wherever they had a need, and and longtime general manager Branch Rickey, as you say, called it coconut snatching, which was a term he picked up in the tropics when he watched people pair up to pick coconuts. One would scale a tree, a palm tree, and hold on with his legs and pick coconuts and drop it to the guy below until his legs tired. And then he would come down the tree and the other guy would shimmy up and hold on. And Rickey took much that same approach, taking guys from one position and plugging them into another as need be. I mean, they had the most durable infield in big league history. And that infield of Garvey, Lopes, Russell, and Say played together for nearly 9 years, which was about twice longer than the next most durable infield ever. And Davey Lopes started as an outfielder, and Bill Russell started as an outfielder, and Steve Garvey started as a third baseman. And the only guy who ended up where he started was Ron Say, and they even tried to move Say to the outfield, which terrified him because he wanted to do was play third base. Luckily, it worked out, and it worked out in the long run. I mean, these guys were the cornerstone of the Dodgers' success for well over a decade.
We're talking with Jason Turbo. His book is called They Bled Blue, about the 1981 Dodgers. Spring training rolled around that year, and a ton of injuries. And was it Lasorda who referred to it as Camp If?
Camp If. Well, he laid it out. Like, we will win the World Series if we maintain health. And if Pedro Guerrero can you know, pick up the pace. And if our backup players can do this. And if our starting pitchers can do that. And the prime injury was to Reggie Smith, who was, you know, the team MVP for several years running. And a very vocal leader in that clubhouse. He had injured his shoulder severely the previous season. And he ended up being unable to do much more than pinch hit for the duration of 1981. He played almost zero innings in the field. And that was a big hurdle to overcome. I mean, he was one of Lasorda's ifs, and that didn't work out the way they had hoped. Luckily, an if that Lasorda didn't even think to ask came around to kind of balance that out in the form of Fernando Valenzuela.
And that's such an amazing story of how he came to them, the work of Mike Brito, and then the guy who played such a role in the success of Valenzuela, Bobby Castillo.
Yeah, well, Bobby Castillo, he was actually drafted by the Kansas City Royals as a third baseman, another coconut-snatching job for the Dodgers, washed out of their system after 1 year, was playing semi-pro ball in Los Angeles as a pitcher when he played the team run by Mike Brito, who is the longtime Dodgers scout, who longtime viewers would recognize as the guy in the Panama hat behind home plate holding a radar gun. He actually struck Brito out with a screwball, of all things, and Brito had never seen anything like it at that level. He used that one pitch to sign up Castillo into the Mexican leagues and subsequently signed him to the Dodgers. When he brought Fernando to the big leagues, Fernando Valenzuela, he took him out of Mexico at 18 years old. The Dodgers decided he needed to learn another pitch. They didn't have anyone who threw a split-finger fastball, which was their first option. But Brito said, hey, I know someone who throws a screwball. And Bobby Castillo, who's from Los Angeles, who went to Mexico to get signed by the Dodgers, brought him all the way back home, ended up teaching Fernando Valenzuela the pitch that made him famous.
Valenzuela lights out right out of the gate, starts the season, what, 7-0, 8-0, hit a little rough stretch along the way, but obviously became a superstar immediately because of the population base. But there's also a wonderful story that you tell in the book about the history of Chavez Ravine.
Yeah, well, Fernando, he really did come out of nowhere. And opening day, 1981, he was 20 years old. He had never made a major league start. He'd come up the previous September for a handful of relief appearances. But through a series of injuries, late breaking and spring training, Fernando found himself as the first rookie pitcher in the 98-year history of the Dodgers to start on opening day. And he ended up throwing a shutout against the class of the National League, the Houston Astros. And his next start, he threw a complete game victory. And his next start after that, he threw another shutout. And his next start after that, he threw another shutout. And his next start after that, he threw another shutout. And during which he went 3-for-4 to bring his season batting average to .438. It was an amazing turn of events. For the Dodgers on the field, obviously, it helped them very much. They got off to the best start in baseball. But off the field, as you mentioned, I think it had even more to do with their ongoing success, and that's because Dodger Stadium is located, as many people know, in a place called Chavez Ravine, which is just about a mile from downtown Los Angeles. But for decades, it had been home to a very vibrant Mexican community, 1,000 strong. They had a couple of schools, they had a post office, they had a church. But the rugged hillsides that separated it from downtown kept it largely undeveloped. In the late 40s, the L.A. mayor decided this was the perfect place to build a giant housing development, low-income housing. And he offered residents first shot at new units as they became available in exchange for their property. Most of the residents took him up on the offer. But before ground could be broken, there was a new election in 1953. A very conservative man named Norris Polson swept in, riding the McCarthyist populace of the McCarthyist politics of the era. He branded subsidized housing as a socialist plot. He scuttled the entire thing, and that left, it left a bunch of Mexicans with no place to live, and B, it left the city of Los Angeles with a lot of empty acreage and not a lot to do with it. And it was at that point that Walter O'Malley decided to move his baseball team from Brooklyn to the West Coast. And the city of Los Angeles said, why don't you put your stadium here? So the Dodgers had sold about 1 million tickets their last season in Brooklyn. They pretty much doubled that their first 4 years in L.A., and that was while they played at the Los Angeles Coliseum while Dodger Stadium was being built. Once Dodger Stadium opened up, they just shattered season ticket sale records almost on an annual basis. Like, they sold 2.75 million tickets their first year in Dodger Stadium in 1962. Everyone wanted to see the Dodgers, except for the local Mexicans, who had long memories. They were justifiably bitter at the treatment. And the Dodgers cared about this because Los Angeles County had a higher concentration of Mexicans there than anywhere else in the world outside of Mexico City. And this was a fan base that they wanted to tap into but couldn't. And they tried to, trot out relatable players from Mexico over the years. None of them were very good until Fernando came along. And like you said, after Fernando's first 8 starts, his record was 8-0. He had thrown 9 innings in every single start. He had thrown 5 shutouts, given up a total of 4 runs. His ERA was 0.5. And it is safe to say, at that point, the Mexican community was engaged. Right? Al Campanas, the general manager, liked to say he wanted to find a Mexican Sandy Koufax, somebody to activate the local Mexicans the way that Koufax had activated the Jews. And Fernando did that and more. And it wasn't just the Mexicans. Everybody was activated. Jaime Harin, the longtime broadcaster, told me that nobody in history had single-handedly created more baseball fans than did Fernando in 1981, and I think that's very, very believable.
In the midst of Fernando mania, there was labor strife bubbling under the surface, and that would all come to a head in mid-June when the players went on strike and would stay out for the better part of 2 months. It was interesting to look back and realize what doesn't seem all that long ago to me, but it was a time when some guys were worried about what they were going to do to make ends meet, had to take on part-time jobs, had to borrow money to get to home, and that's how much baseball has changed just in the intervening 38 years.
That's true. And the veteran players were fairly well set, and the Dodgers were a team full of veteran players. But many of the younger players had no cash liquidity. Dave Stewart was a rookie that year. He went on to win many, many games for the A's later in his career. He was making $17,000 a year, and he actually had to take a job in a hardware manufacturer facility, boxing nuts and bolts, among other duties. And you better believe that people in that warehouse were very happy to see a major league ball player come to work every day and get to hang out with him. But it was a wildly different landscape than we know now.
And because of the strike, we ended up with the whole split season, a different playoff structure. But despite that, some great playoff series, taking on the Astros again after what had happened previously with them, and then the Yankees in the World Series. It really was a wonderful postseason. And some of the guys came up big and performed in unexpected ways in that postseason for them.
Well, yeah. I mean, between the Astros and the Yankees was the Montreal Expos, the National League Championship Series. The Astros series, by the way, was the first ever divisional series in Major League Baseball history because of the first half, second half champions. Up until then, it had just been one playoff series and the winner goes to the World Series. So that set a new precedent. But against Montreal in the NLCS, it came down to game 5 of a 5-game series, and Rick Monday hit the game-winning home run in the late innings in Montreal. and it happened to be on a Monday, and that game is forever known as Blue Monday in Montreal. And I will say, since this book has come out, I have taken so much good-natured grief from Expos fans, long-standing Expos fans. That was as close as they came to the World Series,
right,
with the possible exception of the 1994 strike season. They still can't stand Rick Monday in a way that has nothing actually to do with Rick Monday. It's kind of sad to see.
And you point out, too, that this was in many ways the end for that group of Dodgers. Eventually, that gang would be broken up. Guys would go their separate ways. And then even that great season in 1981 would be surpassed by what happened in 1988.
Yeah, this team knew that this was their last chance. You know, that infield had been together forever. The outfield was full of veterans. The pitching staff, with the exception of Fernando Valenzuela, was very veteran. And contracts were coming up, and even more importantly, the Dodgers farm system was stocked. And all these veterans came into the season saying out loud, like, if we're going to win a World Series together, this is probably our final shot. And they knew it going in, and they got into deep holes against the Astros. They went down 2-0 in a 5-game series. They went down 2-1 in a 5-game series against the Expos. They lost the first 2 games of a 7-game series against the Yankees, and they won every one of those series. And part of it was because of the fortitude they had in having lost the 77 and 78 World Series and knowing that they were about to be broken up. And sure enough, they were. Davey Lopes was traded that offseason. A year later, Ron Say and Steve Garvey were gone. And the Dodgers that ended up winning in 1988 were completely different. Every veteran was off the roster from 81.
Well, it is a wonderful read, and I didn't want to talk a lot about the postseason. Not that we can have spoilers. It's history. People can look it up, but it's worth reading just for that. But I love the book so much. Loved revisiting these great characters. You've done it again. The book is called They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen. Jason Turbo, thanks again for coming back to visit with us, and much success with the book.
Those are great compliments. Thank you very much. Might I just say that I blog regularly at baseballcodes.com, mostly about baseball's unwritten rules, the topic of my first book. But come on along and check in.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot, Jason.
Thank you.